join us?
The work session's in order. Okay, first off, we have the roll call. Gary East is out. John Updike?
Present.
Mr. Golden Gate? Vice Chairman Commissioner Bob Berman?
Present.
Just Commissioner Jim Hanselman?
I am also here.
The ever-popular Ms. Blom?
Here.
And last but not least, other than me, we have Braulio.
I am here today, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Everybody's present and accounted for. New business, oh, pardon me.
Sorry, I have something in my throat.
No, I got him. I got Updike.
Oh, but this guy's sitting over here?
Yeah, his shirt wasn't loud enough, so I kind of missed him. He was fading into the woodwork. It wasn't the Hawaiian.
Hawaiian print, yeah.
Okay. The chief architect is here. Okay. New businesses.
Ready?
Yeah, we're ready.
Fantastic. Derek Tokos, Community Development. We had met with Thompson Sanitary back in November about putting some standards in place to address some of the concerns they have, namely with multifamily.
Yep, I remember that.
But with, you know, commercial, larger commercial projects kind of fit into that same basket. And so I put together some language based on a number of examples that are out there. I have passed that along to them, and my plan would be to meet with them or at least confirm that they're comfortable with where this is going in time to land this back on your work session for your next meeting. If there's any adjustments they feel need to be made, they'd have a chance to talk to you about it before it actually goes to hearing. Hearing would be, if you're willing to initiate the legislative process, the hearing would be in June. It'd be your June meeting. So I'm going to go ahead and put these on the big screen here. So, added it to Chapter 11 of the of our zoning code, which is the Title 14 of the Municipal Code. This is where we already have some other incidental standards for multifamily, for example. And so, solid waste and recycling enclosure and access requirements. I didn't want to put. I was focusing on putting just what we think are critical, because anything that lands in a municipal code is something we have to review and make sure is in place before a project moves forward. If it's in guidelines, and a lot of jurisdictions have fairly detailed guidelines, these things get down to exactly how you configure your gate installation and footings on that kind of stuff. And that's a level of detail. Guidelines are more appropriate because, you know, there may be site-specific circumstances where certain things are or are not done because you're dealing with reality on the ground. And so this is more about what kind of baseline standards do we want to have in place, in particular to address what happened in Surfview, where you have a large number of buildings and they choose to go with one enclosure with a compactor that's not proximate to any of the other buildings that are, you have two buildings that it's reasonably close to, the balance not so much. But it also brought to mind ADA requirements, which, you know, for accessible buildings, you actually do have an ADA requirement that the trash enclosure be accessible. Kind of makes sense. If you're disabled and you have, you know, disabled access to a building and disabled access to the parking, you would have disabled access to trash enclosure, because like anybody else, you've got to deal with that. Ironically, the dumpster and compactors are not subjected to that. It's the enclosure. So they could be able to get to the enclosure, put your trash there. It doesn't mean the dumpster's necessarily going to be accessible, but it's the best you can do.
That I assume you're saying that that facility is an accessible facility, was designed and built that way.
Right.
But they don't have any elevators, so how do they?
Your accessible units are on the main floor.
Okay.
You're not required to make all units accessible. Only a percentage of your units are required to be accessible. But also, accessibility is not limited to multifamily, so we do want to keep that in mind. Commercial also has accessibility. Employees, there are folks who are employees who have mobility issues, and so we need to think about it in both those contexts. But yeah, it's main floor. It's where you'd have, and you have both fully accessible units on a main floor, and then you have convertible, what we call convertible units. So they can be made accessible, but they aren't as they're presently constructed. So you have two kind of flavors to that.
On number two, enclosed area shall contain sufficient space to accommodate solid waste and recycling. Should we spell out solid waste recycling and yard waste or compostable waste? I mean, Thompson's provides that.
Not the multifamily places, though, I don't think.
Oh.
Yeah, they have gardeners that do that, right?
Well,
I mean, I think it's a great idea, don't get me wrong, but I think that they already only provide composting bins to residential or, you know, single residential or small stuff. I don't think they pick them up.
I can talk to them about it. I'll talk to Thompson's about it.
I thought they might. That's a good idea to include it if they.
Absolutely. I mean, if people.
People have house plants that buy and coffee grounds and.
Yeah.
Eggshell. I mean, people. Yeah. A lot
it's
of people.
It's not yard waste in that circumstance.
It's compostable.
Yeah. Other.
Yeah.
Compost.
No,
Derek, on
plywood.
On A.
Applicability.
Plywood can't go in there. You list these kinds of buildings. I don't know what those multifamily, commercial, institutional, industrial. Are those defined somewhere in the code? Or. The reason it came up because I think public should be in there if that's a type of building.
Typically, that would be an institutional building.
Okay. All
right. Schools and stuff, right?
Frankly, I could probably just get by. I've looked at that a couple different times. I probably can get by with just multifamily and commercial. Anything that goes under the Oregon Structural Specialty Code, which is going to pick up that whole battery. I mean, that's another way for me to frame it. Your one and two family is in your residential code. Everything else is in the structural code. So I could, that's the other way I could do it is just say
any
building subject, new building under the structural code.
Okay. And but, the alternative approach, I'd like to see the city be involved in that since it's our regulations. I would change it to solid waste and recycling service provider and the city of Newport.
Oh. That's a good point. What about the height too, Derek, on number one? So traditionally, wouldn't these be in the front, in theory, of a building, and then the height limit on the front of a building for a fence is 3 feet, right, in the city?
Well, typically you wouldn't necessarily put that in the front of a multifamily project. Usually you don't have it as too visible.
I mean, we have one in Toledo right now, and Dole's making
in
us
your
put
front
it.
Yard.
They're making us put it along the street, just like for how their trucks work. Hmm. It's just a little like conflicting code language, right? Where if it has to be in the front, then it's a 6-foot high fence when the city only allows a 3-foot high fence.
Yeah, but fences, aren't an enclosure. I can clarify that.
Oh, instead of fence, you're saying closure. Yeah, that would solve it.
If the developer and the provider of the service have reached an agreement as to an alternative than what you've proposed in your code, why is there a need for the city to then intervene on something as minute as the collection of the garbage cans?
Because they don't care about how it looks. theory, right?
I mean, the principals have reached an accommodation.
Well, the principal could change. And I just think a real quick review by the planning department, community development department, would guarantee that it, whatever their alternative solution, conforms to all the other requirements that may be buried in various places in the code. Because neither the developer nor the provider necessarily knows all the details of the various aspects of the code.
That's why they would come to the counter and ask what they're able to do. It seems to me by if they know the rules and they've reached an accommodation, why we add another layer of bureaucracy or some barrier for the two folks that have already reached an agreement?
I just think it's important to have the city be there to sign off that, yes, it still meets the code, even though it's an alternative arrangement. That, my opinion, I'm not hung up on it by any means, but it just seems to me that if you're gonna vary from the code, provisions of the ordinance, that at least at a minimum, the city should be aware of it, and in my opinion, should sign off on that variance also.
I mean, you could touch on aesthetics that way. I mean, I think I can speak from experience. It's the absolute last thing we ever think of when we're designing a building, you know, apartment complex. It's like, oh yeah, we need an enclosure for the trash. And it's usually a last thought. Oh yeah.
It is.
Let's put something around this.
Dustin, what was your experience then?
I mean, we're doing an apartment complex right now, and with, you know, we had this discussion like 2 weeks ago, and they're like, oh, we, you know, we draw our box of this is where the trash goes. But like the actual logistics of what it looks like, and the developer is putting in something that's nice, it'll look good. But people don't have to do that, right? They just, it's an afterthought usually.
Not presently, but yeah. But you know, these get at, you know, screening them from public view. I mean that's B1 that we would put in place. And anyway, just kind of running through it. I've jotted down these notes. I don't really have an issue with the city. I mean, they're going to have to provide it to us in writing. And if there's, you know, I don't have a problem with the city, you know, signing off on it too. That's fine.
What if you say Eric, it has to be away from the front?
Would it be clear, though, if the city of Newport says no to an alternative, is it clear what the path is to resolve that?
Well, I think there would have to be a reason why we wouldn't be signing it off, and that's a discussion point about adjustments that would need to be made so that sign-off can happen.
Okay, so you're comfortable we didn't create too much vagarity for you to navigate?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe as an alternative that the written agreement be provided to your office for the file. That way the city knows what's happened, the developer knows what's happened, and the and Thompson's knows what the agreement is.
Yeah, the expectation when it says it's in writing that we would have to have documentation of what the alternative arrangement is.
So you'd know it'd go into the
building file.
It wouldn't require that extra step of your approval or somebody in the city's approval.
Well, would this all be determined prior to plan review?
It would be part of plan review.
So you're going to have a look at it anyway, no matter what, whether we include that in there or not.
Right, but the downside to having the city sign off on it is what would be my basis to not sign off? That's the challenging piece.
Well, the basis would be the fence is only 3 foot high. They decided between the two of them that a 3 foot high fence was okay in that circumstance. Well, the code says 6 foot high. So then it becomes either an adjustment or a variance. It just says all the provisions. They can waive any of the provisions of the code, and I think the city should have to agree to that.
Yeah, because that's my take on this, unless the word approach literally means where the truck drives to access a waste dump. But this seems to be all-inclusive. So any part of this ordinance that the developer and the waste disposal, solid waste and recycling service provider agree to may not, I mean, they may agree to it, but it may not have anything to do with what we were hoping for. Now, I don't think that would happen very often, that they would do something silly, shall we say, but I do think that the city needs to be aware of what the plan is so they can quickly flag it and just say, oh, well, that's not what we mean, or clarify this language. I have to think that Bob's onto something here, I do.
And maybe they don't belong, you brought that up, Derek, and this is, it seems like a very targeted code change for a specific problem that they're dealing with right now. But maybe trash enclosures don't belong on the front of a property line. Maybe there's like some rubric where you pick like trash enclosures can't be located within the first like a third of the property line from like front to rear, some sort of distance that maybe you don't want trash enclosures right up against the city street. I mean, that would seem reasonable to me.
My thought is this whole issue was brought to us by Mr. Thompson, and it was a concern that they had. And so we're trying to, you know, accommodate him and make sure that the waste is properly taken care of. I just can't see a scenario where Mr. Thompson would sign off on an agreement with the developer that would be, you know, strongly adverse to what you're trying to propose here. He's going to be looking out for his interests and the safety of his equipment and his staff.
So, Burley, you're proposing just remove like that last, unless an alternative approach is approved, that shouldn't exist, right? Because it should just be through the city standard.
I'm trying to think this through so that, you know, the rules are clear without being overly burdensome to folks. And so my only thought was if Mr. Thompson and developer ABC have come to an agreement, and that agreement is then provided and reviewed by the city, that should be enough rather than looking for, you know, a formal approval from the city.
I'm okay with this, with administrative sign off from us. I mean, you know, here's why this language, where you do have these types of provisions in zoning codes, you tend to have an outlet like this, and it's because you can't think of every circumstance where you're trying to deal with different property on different terrain, dealing with different issues. It may be, Dustin, that the only location that you could actually put it in a manner in which they could actually access it happens to be in the front yard. But maybe there's some things they can do to mitigate the visual impact. We don't know, because you know, all those would be site by site, you know. So it's important to have an outlet. I don't know that you guys want to see adjustments for trash enclosures at the Planning Commission level. It's a pretty small thing. So I think just putting some language in here that we have it in writing and it's signed off by the provider in the city, that's fine by me.
Dustin, on the project that you're working on, has this issue come up?
I mean, it was resolved because we reached out to him early on the location of it. It's more like the aesthetics and the screening and stuff that has been an afterthought.
The developer pushing back or amenable to?
No, I mean, they were flexible with it. It wasn't an issue in that particular instance, but I mean, I see Derek's point at the end of the day. I always end up supporting something that I then work on a project and regret my decision because then I have to suddenly design to it and there's unique circumstances. And you can't put like vague languages, like we encourage it to be towards the rear or something, because right, it means nothing.
There's, you know, moving along again, these, we just talked a little bit about receptacle height.
That's fine.
Okay.
I was looking at, B3. So when we get there, let me know.
Sure. You know, so I just really focused on enclosure requirements and access. And there are other aspects of trash management that can come into play, but those are generally addressed under guidelines. And I really wanted to avoid trying to calculate how much space somebody needs. I think that really is a function of a discussion with, what is the nature of the particular commercial use? How, and even multifamily in terms of how it's configured and set up. And so that's really a discussion with Thompson's. really, I think our interest is ensuring that the enclosures, you know, can house the receptacles, or in a case where you have a dumpster, which is a drop box, or compactor, you have some additional space, because moving those in and out can damage everything. So to have a little bit of clearance on there, that's the 2-foot requirement. Whereas, you know, carts can be pulled out, they're not going to probably damage the enclosure. If you're snug on a drop box, good luck not damaging the enclosure. Gate openings, you know, I'll talk to Thompson's about it, but, you know, and really part of that too, that's 12 feet's pretty common when you get into the world of drop box and compactors. It can be even bigger depending on how big the drop box or compactor is. You got a 12-foot minimum for your access typically. Some provisions here, you know, a side gate, separate pedestrian gate, and multifamily. That's one that comes up so that they're not having to deal with a larger, you know, larger gate structure.
We need to specify depth.
Not, you know, if they have 2 feet of clearance around the drop box and compactor, that should give you a pretty good size of how big it needs to be. I get a little bit nervous about trying to specify specific dimensions because of just the variety of different ways they can configure their handling of waste. They can combine a number of different carts. They can do carts in a compactor. There are lots of different ways they can do that.
So on that number 3,
yeah.
I noticed in at least 2 of these sample codes that you provided, mm-hmm. which were, that was great selection, I thought. Whether it was one, I couldn't figure out. But they there were a couple of them that required some kind of latching on the gate. With the winds we get around here, I think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Could be a real danger to that driver gets out of the truck and the gate comes back. And
okay. If you've got drop boxes or compactors, they're pretty heavy, so there's a concrete pad requirement for them. That's what 4 gets at. And that they be spaced away from combustible walls. When you get into a drop box, now you're getting into a larger volume of material, and if you get something in there, they dumpster fire. Gotta love that term, but anyway. So that's what I had for the enclosure standards, and then you have for access. This is, you know, again, this principally gets at your drop box and compactors because they actually have to come back in, and you know, whereas if it's your carts, they'll just deal with that curbside, but with your compactor, they're going to have to back their vehicles in there, and so need to have some specific standards. That seems to be pretty close to what you need there, which is the 50 feet in length, given the length of their vehicles, at least 12 feet in width, and at least 18 feet of vertical clearance, 23 feet above the enclosure itself. Kind of creates kind of that area so that they have sufficient access to get in there and deal with that equipment.
Do we, can they put that enclosure within 6 feet of the property line, or can they put it like right on the property line?
Look at me.
You know, typically well, property, you got a number of different property lines. Yes, you can put it right on a property line. Typically, if you're in a front yard area, as Dustin points out, we have reduced height allowances for fences. Principally because of vehicle line of sight issues. So when you're backing out of your driveway, if you had a 6-foot fence in your front yard, you won't be able to see until, you know, you're in a conflict with a pedestrian or another vehicle. So care would need to be taken if it's in a front yard area. But it's not uncommon to see them tucked up on a property line on a side or a rear.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they're not so large that would cause any difficulty, typically.
Well, I just remember when we were discussing the hotel
Yeah.
The lady next to, there wasn't going to be enough room for her to go in and repair her stuff because they were going to take it right to the property line, which they can do commercially. So that was my thought was, you know, particularly in commercial type establishments, I put a dumpster right on the property line and those, having had dumpsters in my life,
yeah,
having, you know, 7 foot, 8 foot high dumpster.
Yep. Yep. Could be an issue.
But I will make it clear that dumpster enclosures are not subject to building setbacks. Because, and that's the, what it is in the code already, but I can put that in explicitly because it's not an occupancy. Our setbacks apply to buildings that are occupied. Decks would be subject to it because again you've got an occupancy on a deck in a building proper where you have an occupancy, but a garden shed is not an occupancy. A dumpster enclosure is not an occupancy. You know.
Okay.
Planter boxes are not occupancies.
One of the codes went into some detail about roofs, and I don't think it's necessary, but I think we ought to hear thoughts on it. with all the rain we get, if those cans, if they were using cans and they don't close them, I know from my own home that they get full of water in quite a hurry. And so I don't know, it seems a shame to go to all the extra expense for a roof, but there is some justification. Anybody have any thoughts on that? I'm not suggesting we add that.
You mean a roof on the garbage can or a roof
on the enclosure? If you fully enclose it, including the roof.
But then won't the trash guys have to get out and open the roof?
Well, they have to get out and open the doors anyway. We're just talking about whether or not there's a roof up there.
Yeah, I didn't dive into roof structures on these. Not sure if we want to.
I think they're one of the hardest things to design, too. I mean, they end up being kites, right? Because you have structure,
the wind gets underneath roof, and whoosh.
And it's a kite, yeah. People, you know, they ask about, we design a carport, and it's amazing how hard it is to hold those down. You end up getting these huge foundations that are trying to hold this kite down.
Thanks, airfoil. Well, I would also suggest that no roof.
I can talk to Thompson about
rain.
That. In
rain
terms
will
of what
keep that area cleaner than no rain.
True. You're getting into an area that's a lot outside of my, you know, expertise. Thompson's is going to have quite a bit of experience in dealing with water saturation of their drop boxes. They may have some thoughts on that. Then the next two standards for access get at what I was talking to you about, which has to do with the accessible route. And I think I took from Ventura's example the 150-foot. Because frankly, it does make a lot of sense. I mean, you can design something as accessible, but if you put it, you know, very, very far away, people aren't going to use it. Thompson's already pointed that out. This is really the way to get at Thompson's concern is that, in my mind, is because your multifamily, for example, is typically going to almost always have accessible units on the main floor. Then they're going to have to be, if we go with this, at least 150 feet, within 150 feet of the enclosure. And I think I gave you a map in here to, the Surfview Village area. So it gives you a sense, you know, they've got their enclosure sitting over here.
We only have the one.
Right, and that was the frustration that Thompson shared. I mean, it's set up well. You know, their vehicles have good access to and from to get at the compactor. But I mean, you've got, if you're in a unit over here, you got a long ways over to get to the trash. Yeah. Now, see the ADA entrances here. Your ADA. So you have your ADA. These are accessible units. And that's your accessible pathways.
So there's not a requirement that to have more than, if you have X amount of units or whatever, you have to have two or three trash enclosures. It's up to the developer.
Well, it really is a bit up to the developer in terms of how many, in this case, if you have a compactor, you can get away with not having, you know, quite the same number.
Oh, okay.
I was trying to avoid, frankly, getting it, trying to measure and calculate how many enclosures, you know, a development needs based on their anticipated waste generation. I was trying to avoid that. You saw a number of examples where that, you know, in guidelines, for example, you can kind of calculate out on a dwelling unit basis. They even broke some of them down based on whether or not it's full family occupancy or individuals. I'd much rather just say, okay, you just have to make sure that you have, you know, enclosures within 150 feet of each building. That's easy enough.
Yeah.
Figure out.
Yeah.
Okay, well, but it says 150.
If it's accessible, 150.
Feet of the entrance to the accessible building.
Right.
Well, each one of those buildings has three entrances, I believe, at least two.
Yeah, I could put nearest. Nearest, I mean, would make sense to your nearest accessible entrance.
Would it be sensible? I mean, it's really twisting this, perhaps, but set that distance, whatever the distance be, 150 feet or whatever, from the rooms that, from the accessibility rooms, those people have the, will have the greatest effort to get to that waste receptacle area. And in this particular case, they have the farthest to go to the, so maybe that's overkill.
But, you know, I didn't see a lot of examples really on this distance stuff. Ventura is the one that jumped out at me as one that made, that actually tried to quantify that. I don't know. I can talk to Thompsons about whether or not they think 150 feet's the kind of the magic distance for something like this.
Yeah, it's just that if you said 100 by the building at the upper left there, you said 150 feet from the first entrance, it's another 100 feet to the next, or to the final entrance up north.
I mean,
so I just wanted maybe be a little bit more specific, and I like Jim's idea about from the any accessible unit no more than 150 feet.
My only concern with that is I'm looking at this, and assuming you have accessible units largely on the main floor, you'd be looking at like four trash enclosures, maybe four or five. I mean, that's a lot. You start to load it up. That's the only concern I'd have.
I'd take out parking or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is configured the way it is. I mean, we had a standard in place, they would have been able to design around some of this. This
is an existing one that Thompson, because I wasn't here in November, that Thompson came to the city and said, hey, we got this issue. And
You guys, we need some standards in place. Okay. When projects are being designed, yeah. Because this is their example.
Okay.
This is a development that is north of town next to the theater.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I see, yeah.
That's where this is.
Okay.
John, do you have any thoughts? You've been quiet on this.
Yeah, am I missing something? So it sounds to me, if the 150 feet from any at all, then wouldn't what we're looking at meet the code? So are we really solving a problem? I think it does have to be from the furthest accessible unit. Well, maybe 150 isn't the right number then, but.
You've got accessible units up here.
Right.
I mean, so this doesn't, I mean, this shows you, this is kind of for one enclosure.
But that first accessible unit is probably within 150 feet of that dumpster.
This building and this building, only two of them.
Yeah.
These two buildings. Are we in each building? These two buildings would be too far away. They wouldn't meet that standard.
So it's 150 feet to the building is the way this is written.
Mm-hmm.
So two of those would work and three wouldn't. Well, I guess that's building on the east there?
Yeah, so you got four buildings here. So these two buildings would meet it. These two buildings wouldn't.
Yeah, you also don't want to have them too close to the buildings.
What's the rationale for including this
this language on the distance from the apartment to the dumpster?
Get people to use them.
Yeah.
You want to, yeah, I mean, part of the issue here that Thompson's is running into is that in this configuration, it's too far for a number of the residents to, for it to be functional.
And probably in that case, isn't it really, I mean, what I've seen done is then you have pans or tubs at other remote locations and some sort of process to get that to a compactor?
Yeah.
Does the code allow for that, or would that be maybe an alternative approach that you would look at and see? Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, that would be an alternative approach that would be, you know, if signed off by the by Thompson's and the city. So we have that alternative pathway in there. Or they may drop an enclosure up here. You know, they could have,
right,
with their initial design, worked an enclosure in here, for example, which would have picked up at least this building.
I just perused like the code of our ADA standards from the Department of Justice and ANSI's A17, yeah, and all it says is the only thing references trash compactors, and it just says you have to have a clear floor area in front of them. There's nothing about proximity.
Correct. Typically, you don't run into that. Most anywhere, even with an accessible pathway from parking, your parking could be a mile away. You have an accessible route to the door, you meet the code. Yeah. That doesn't mean somebody with a disability is going to use it, because they probably don't want to go that far. So, are you guys generally comfortable with this? Or
I think we all understand the intent here. And if somebody's looking to circumvent, they're going to have to work it out with Thompson's in the city.
Right. And I can talk to Thompson's about the 150-foot and you know, tying it to the accessible pathway provisions. And if they have other thoughts, I'm happy to bring it back at your next work session. You can take a look at it. I'm hoping you can just at your regular session, do your motion to initiate the legislative process so we can get that 35-day DLCD notice.
Oh, later today?
Yeah, at the regular session.
But Derek, if the concern is that folks who have accessibility issues aren't using the dumpster, what are they doing with their debris?
Well, Thompson's had a number of photos where, you know, trash is not being hauled all the way to the compactor. You know, part of this also gets at management of a complex of this size, and that was all part of the discussion too. And I want to be clear, Thompson's argument wasn't that people with mobility issues weren't using it. It was that people generally weren't using it because it was just too far away from a number of the units. And that in their view, something, a facility of that size should have had more than...
So it's a management issue from the developer's end.
That's part of it, certainly.
And we've heard that on other topics about this particular facility, about the various complaints, the police calls, lots of stuff going on there that's a result of what apparently is poor management, I can't say.
What sure. I like about tying it to accessibility is it forces a developer then to think about where they place their accessible units relative to their trash enclosures. Because the people that need to be, if you have an option, they don't have to put accessible units all on them. What they could do is they could say, okay, I'm going to put my accessible units right on this side, and these appear, maybe not. You know, thinking not just accessible pathway from where folks are parked, but also an accessible route to a trash enclosure that's a reasonable distance for somebody with a mobility, challenge to get to and from. Because a person who doesn't have a mobility issue, they can walk a little bit further. But somebody who's trying to haul that there and they're in a wheelchair, and maybe you know, there's some thought ought to be put to not having your accessible units as far away as possible from trash enclosure. Or if you're gonna do that, how else are you gonna accommodate those individuals so that...
Well, I have seen a lot of developments larger than this, and they have to have multiple waste stations. And I think the way they've gotten around the concept of people not using them is to build nice waste areas near the entrance or exit to the development. And so people throw the bag in the trunk or in the back seat, and on their way to work, they stop at the waste station and get rid of their waste because it's on the way. It's part of their travel mode. And that seemed I never lived in one, but I had many friends that did, and I don't recall seeing those developments ever trashed. Mm-hmm. They always seemed pretty clean. Now, maybe they had a great outdoor staff that policed the area all the time, but...
Are you put them by the mailbox. That's the condo that lived before.
Yeah.
It was, you know...
Yeah.
We can't regulate the management side of it too. So what happens at this particular development if their management's having a difficulty with certain tenants, we can't. There's nothing we can do.
No, it's really the human nature of convenience. If it isn't convenient for me, I'm not going to do it. You know, so that's just too far for me to walk.
If we spend 40 minutes on trash enclosures and access. You have a few minutes for to talk parking?
Yeah, so true.
Item 2B, continued discussion regarding parking at the Bayfront.
Yeah.
Oh my. We've never actually discussed this before, have we?
Oh, you're a funny guy tonight.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to just bring up a map.
I didn't park on that. The other day had dinner at Local Ocean, and I parked at their parking lot. And then I realized we were done eating. We went for a walk, and I was like, oh, I should move my car.
You park in the Local Oceans, or you park in one of the fisherman spots?
No, it was the Local Ocean. Yeah, not the fisherman spot.
I'm going to kind of run through this, and I'm going to run it.
I don't think it was one of the...
I haven't shared it yet. Let me just go and put this... The direction you're seeing a number of jurisdictions go, and I could have attached some others, part of it in Oregon, it has to do with the climate-friendly and equitable communities rules that we're not currently subject to, but by the end of this legislative session could very well be subject to, relative to parking. So, there are a number of jurisdictions in around the country. I provided a link to an article with a dynamic map that showed what different jurisdictions around the country are doing. The trend actually is to do away with off-street parking requirements, either citywide or in commercial districts where you've got public parking. So the Bayfront would be an example, of that. And certainly one option, what we have agreed to, what our council had put in place as part of policy, is that when we meter, put in the meters and permit program in the Bayfront, we're to either reduce or eliminate off-street parking requirements. That's a trade-off in policy that's been adopted. So the question before the commission is, do we reduce or do we eliminate? So one easy way would be to just eliminate off-street parking requirements in the Bayfront once the meter and permit program's up. And then you'll get whatever development you're going to get. And if a developer feels that their particular activity is going to have a demand for parking and they can't accommodate it and they don't see it being accommodated in the public realm, they're not going to locate there. That's the rationale, is that development will provide the parking it needs. There's no reason for a local government to say you must have X number of parking spaces per, 1,000 square feet, depending on your necessary use. You also have a few jurisdictions that put in place parking maximums. We're not dealing with parking maximums at this point. But yeah, Bob?
Would this be essentially retroactive if we were to do it? In other words, the current businesses that are subject to having to have off-street parking, could they then expand their building or whatever, get rid of that parking lot?
That's the concept. And if you noticed, the number of the spots that I highlight on this map are existing parking lots. They're either required to, or in some cases, they just have historically been used as parking. I mean, over here by the Maritime Museum, that most of this is owned by the Historical Society, and they've had arrangement with the port for that to be fishermen's parking for some time. But that's just an arrangement they've had. That's not long-term binding anything. They could choose to do something else with that property. You also have Local Ocean, who, when they did the last restaurant addition, had to add off-street parking. They've got paved parking area next to them. That would be in play.
So they could say, well, we don't need to have it anymore, and they could double the size of their restaurant, assuming they meet all the other requirements.
And we wouldn't have a provision that stops it. Would they double the size of their restaurant,
well,
given
or,
the available parking?
A,
they may not.
Or
they may
sell
say,
it and have somebody else build on. They could do anything they wanted with that land, and the net effect would be that we would have fewer parking spaces in the Bayfront.
Yeah, you would have circumstances where that happens. A number of these properties, you know, on the flip side, they would argue, why are we being held to having to provide parking? Whereas 80% of the businesses down here provide zero.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, that's the, you know, that's the flip side of it.
If this were to go through, then except for the other adjustments, the hotel would have been fine. And
true.
Would not have had to have any of those 47 spots that they were able to provide.
Yeah, but would the hotel have moved forward without parking? I doubt it. I think they would have been providing off-street parking, notwithstanding whatever our code requirement is, because it's a convenience for their guests.
Yeah,
they're going to want that. They're not going to want to load all of those guests into public parking, and it's some of which isn't even that proximate to where they would be staying. That's the principle behind this, is that you know, jurisdictions that are lifting their off-street parking requirements are doing that because they expect and believe that as development happens, the developer, whoever that may be, will be providing that parking where it's necessary.
But we just saw in the hotel, they weren't. They were willing to try to eliminate the required number of parking spaces so that they would have an economic benefit.
The hotel's on appeal. I'll just ignore.
So obviously,
we'll see how that goes.
Beyond
but,
our scope.
But as I pointed out in the staff report, there, they provided as a proportion of their overall parking demand more off-street parking with their project than what existed with the previous development.
That's true.
That was factually shown. So proportionally,
but the other folks were grandfathered in, Derek.
Well, no. What I'm
the
saying is
Piptide and the Piptide successor.
Yeah, but they had some percentage of off-street and some percent of on-street that they were utilizing to support those uses. But proportionally, the Piptide, Apollo's, whatever you want to call it, plus Thai restaurant and Sharks and the Fornash, proportionally, they were hitting the public space harder than this hotel was.
Which is entirely different. I mean, an entertainment or a tavern is entirely different than a hotel where people are going to stay, you know, overnight or for several hours.
Sure. Every commercial use has different periods of time where they utilize parking, whether it's private or public parking. So hotels tend to have a distribution where people are coming, you know, you have a lot of activity in the mornings when people are departing. You have a lot of activity around check-in time. You know, whereas if you're a fish processing plant, you're going to have a lot of activity on your shifts. When you're a restaurant, you're going to have a lot of activity. For example, like Local Ocean, say, over your lunchtime or dinner time. So all uses have different dynamics associated with when they're using. And not all of them are at the same time. I mean, you have some, and I think you could probably demonstrate that with lodging and restaurants, you have a little bit of different use at different times. You know, that's that's just inherent to just your activity with commercial uses. The trick we run into, I was going to run through a few of these real quick just so you could see. I mean, so you have that on the east end, you have that area where you have parking that's currently used by commercial fishing on the Maritime Museum's property, and you have the local ocean. As you move over, you have another parking lot here by the Sail Inn where it's commercial fishing. Then you have that big section of dock here that's falling into the bay, has been for a number of years, California Shellfish, right next to our public parking lot and Pacific Seafood's operations. Someday that large section of dock's going to get rebuilt and actually put to functional use.
Is that privately owned?
Yeah, it's owned by Pacific Seafood.
Okay.
And they've been trying to come up with a public-private funding stream to get that dock rebuilt, because I think it's a little bit more than they've been in a position to do by themselves. And so they've been looking to try to leverage Economic Development Administration dollars, yes, or Connect Oregon. They went after some of those dollars to try to say, hey, can we do some sort of public-private partnership that makes sense, that would give us the funding to rebuild the dock? But the point is, if they rebuild that dock, you're going to have more economic activity at that location. It could be in an existing buildings where the additional dock space allows for more productivity, and so they can have more robust, processing activity. Or it could be just straight up terminal activity where they're offloading seafood and trucking it. Or it could be a new building that happens along there. You could have new retail with docks to the back. I mean, you could have different things that could occur there. Then you have redevelopment, like the 1886 building. We all know that was torn down. That's going to get rebuilt. But it would be replacing an existing impact. It's not like the site didn't have an impact at some point on in terms of your economic activity. Then you got others like the parking lot for the little mini mart down there, which is right next to the public parking. They may or may not want to do something there. Or you've got the segment over by over in this end, you've got some properties. Yeah, you got the retail that's falling into the bay that's currently, that was Bay 39. Everything basically from the pier up to Bornstein is more or less vacated right now because of rotten pile. The buildings are falling down. But you can expect that to redevelop. Would it redevelop the same or more intensely? Hard to say. Bornstein has, when they acquired the property from the city, there's a big section in here where they don't currently have dock because it had rotted away. You've got some old worn piling. But they certainly have plans to fill that in at some point, which would give them additional capacity. I mean, it's not unlimited redevelopment opportunities, but I wanted to at least give you a sense of, what do we have down there right now that could develop? And if we have reduced or eliminated off-street parking requirements, could reasonably develop? And then some things to think about. You could put in place carpool, vanpool requirements where where employers over a certain size have to provide that option. I mean, these are some things that we can do. We could, with reductions, the trick is coming up to, and I'd have to put some hard thought to, what rationally could we do as a reduction? We don't want to spitball stuff. We want to tie it to something that's rational. In terms of a reduction, it could be a reduction in just straight up off the existing parking ratios and look at, okay, how much do we have in terms of public parking and try to correlate that. I don't know. I'd have to, I mean, it's a numbers game at that point.
If you don't ultimately get rid of it altogether, though, the problem with parking is you have to have the access to get into the spaces. So unless it's a requirement of one parking space, like, you lose the efficiencies, right? You still have to have curb cuts. You still have to have a drive aisle that goes in. to access the parking space, and that's what takes up all the volume and all the lots on the bayfront.
Well, you mean if you, you know, what?
If you don't do like a hard elimination, no off-street parking requirement within this parking zone.
Well, if we do, if we eliminate off-street parking, that doesn't mean you're not going to get it in certain circumstances.
Oh, you still will. I agree with you 100%. There's no one's going to put in a hotel without any parking. Like it just because the market won't allow it. People won't stay there.
Right.
So that's free market taking care of it. I mean, I guess I live, you know, overlooking the Abbey Street parking lot. So I see it every single morning and I wake up at 5 a.m. and I run and I'm always blown away that there's probably 30, 40 cars parked before any business is open on the bayfront.
Well, that's shift work.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's the point is I think the demand that we see and like the perceived lack of parking is because the lots are already full and it's because it's convenient for people to park there and leave their cars there.
Well, and we want to keep in mind that this trade-off that we're looking to put in place, we're only putting this in because we're metering and permitting those areas. So that's going to influence that very behavior you're talking about.
Yeah. And free up parking spaces, right?
Right.
I mean, I'm not a traffic engineer, but
and improve,
yeah,
no, makes that's sense. That's proven, and it's going to improve turnover rates.
Yeah.
And, you know, that may or may not be as successful as we want it day one, but the beauty of it is that can be adjusted and dialed in. You know, yeah. Okay, do we need to increase our meter permit fees or reduce the period of time from a four-hour time limit to a three-hour time limit? You know, do we need to adjust the permit fee rates in different areas? That's all stuff that can be adjustable to get the behavior change you're looking for.
I'm worried the fees are going to be too low and everyone's just going to buy it. And so then you'll still at 5 o'clock in the morning have, you know, 30 of the spaces full and, yeah, use.
I take your point. And you know, but at the end of the day, I think that's going to end up having to be a policy-making choice by elected officials. And sometimes the easier route is let's get something in place, see how it goes. If it's not meeting our needs, then we adjust it instead of shooting high, you know, because they're going to get pushback too.
Yeah.
What are you looking for from us?
What are you looking for when you see, you know, okay, you guys know what the dynamic is here. I mean, a palette of options. You want some options that you want? You know, I mean, two or three different options of structuring this, and you can pick one that you can...
That makes sense to me.
You know, just try to, you know, so one of the options will be lifting it entirely. Then maybe a couple different options that involve reductions in a couple different ways. Maybe try to tackle it that way.
The point with reductions, though, is if you look at the lots that are developable, they're too small because they're parking lots right now, right? A lot of them where you could see development, they're parking lots right now. They're too small to develop if any requirement still stays. I'll use Clearwater, for example. So across the street from Clearwater, they have their parking lot. Mm-hmm. If you cut that in half, you really can't put a building there, at least not like a meaningful building where you could really generate much, right? Because you still have that drive aisle, the trash enclosure, and then there, you know, the parking requirement there. You'd have to lift it in order for that lot to be developed. You'd have to lift it in order for the barge to be developed. You'd have to lift it for Laura to do anything with her parking lot. It's small. I looked at designing something on that particular lot. It's tight. It's not easy to fit something on there.
Well, with reductions, when I'm thinking about a couple different reductions, one could be a straight percentage reduction. You know, another one could be an elimination for development up to a certain scale or intensity, and then trigger above that. I mean, that
would be a good one. Where, oh, that's fair. That's like a grocer, for example, or something that's generating like a lot of trips. Then okay, fine.
Right, like, and then you have to find a way to. And yeah. Say above this, you're going to have to provide. But the trick is coming up with a threshold that makes sense.
Yeah.
Now some of that may be, maybe we're going to have to go in and do an assessment on a number of these undeveloped properties and figure out, well, how could they reasonably redevelop and use that as a way of keying that threshold.
When one of the goals be to make sure that the bayfront is developed, I mean, depending on the use, I'm just saying, in general, you would like to see more.
Yeah, I don't know that there's anybody who would argue that they want to continue to see that right there. So, granted, you know, I think there is a nice little evergreen tree that's probably about, what, 6 feet tall now? Climb it up between, but I think the objective is definitely to see, you know, robust development and redevelopment opportunities down here. You know, but, you know, we have a finite amount of area. We know the parking arrangement's not working well now.
Right, right.
So we'll be putting in meters and permits to address that. And so what do we do with these parking standards? Do we reduce them entirely?
I like the options that...
I'd like some thought. With metering,
mm-hmm.
Well, let me back up. And I'll use the hotel as an example. The hotel had to have so many parking places for the hotel itself, for its guests.
Yeah.
And then it was also assessed the need for some number of public parking places. Are those based on previous usages of that property? I mean, whatever would be on the bottom floor of that hotel would need spaces, because they were asking for like 17, an option, or a, they wanted a number omitted because of this and that. With metering, does that change the number of daily round trips that are used to establish the parking requirements for some businesses?
No, it doesn't change. I mean, a business is going to be what it is. Those parking ratios kind of relate to, you know, standardized studies nationwide of different types of uses as to why, you know, you have these parking ratios. But what metering and permits will do is they're going to increase the turnover rate on the utilization of those stalls.
And because of that, wouldn't that mean that there'd be less parking required? If there's a turnover and there's going to be more availability, that means everyone would have to provide fewer because of the high turnover.
Correct. That's thus the trade-off. Either reduce or eliminate the off-street parking requirements because you're getting better utilization and turnover on your public spaces.
Yeah, but we don't have any chart or equation, differential equation, that tells us how that is going to affect what was previously used to base parking requirements for a business. Now it will be different simply because of the higher turnover. Why would, if with higher turnover, why would you need the same number of parking spaces that you needed previously?
Right. Correct.
So there's got to be a change in how many the city is expecting a business to provide or not take away, you know, not pressure the current public parking.
I think the argument for the eliminating the off-street parking requirements, say, don't try to figure out what the appropriate reduction is, because whatever you come up with is invariably going to be wrong. So just focus on your meter and permit program, and if it's not functioning and getting you the turnover you're looking for, adjust up your pricing, or, you know, I mean, that's effectively what you're doing.
Or the hours of parking.
Or the hours of parking to get what you need, and focus on that and not worry about the off-street parking.
Okay.
On the, you know, but that may not be where a majority you are. You may want to say, hey, look, you know, we can do that, but only up to a certain point. If it gets to be a very, very large development, we're going to still want to see some additional off-street parking to increase our supply.
Well, except that, I mean, that was your argument before, is mm-hmm. that if they need it, they're going to put it in.
That's where I tend to fall. I think that's a reasonable and rational way to approach it. It's not the only approach. Not all jurisdictions have lifted off-street parking, but that's the direction things are going.
My big concern is the permits. And if, you know, 200-300 permits are purchased. What if the seafood processors say, this is ridiculous, I'm going to purchase a permit for every single one of my employees, regardless whether they work night shift, day shift, or whatever, and those 40, 50, 60 spaces are gone out of the northern half. They can't purchase a permit right by the plant, but that a large proportion of the available spots end up being taken by permitted parking where they sit there for 8 hours a day and we don't get any turnover. Mm-hmm. And that's my concern about. But that's a somewhat different topic than the required off-street parking thing. But
I feel like this was always pitched that way, though, right? I mean, when the traffic study went forward, that was the whole point. Like, okay, that was sort of the carrot that was hung out. Like, we're going to remove off-street parking requirements.
Reduce or remove. It's always been framed that way.
Yeah, but there are two lots on the Bayfront, the Hallmark property and the Eggerd's property. Those are the two properties that I think that can actually develop to anything that would actually have, like, a traffic-generating requirement. And they would be able to do off-street parking if they wanted to. I mean, I can't think of anything you could put in there with the infill development that we're talking about that would actually generate that, like, trips that would necessitate off-street parking. You know, you're talking about, like, coffee shops. I'm thinking, remember Brody wanted to put in, like, a, what was it, like a real estate / brewery thing, and he wasn't able to do that because he couldn't get the off-street parking space. You know, there's... That's what we're talking about. We're talking about, like, local business owners who are trying to do, like, little things in these little infill lots and bring those businesses there. It's not, there's two properties that are ready for, like, mass development unless someone's willing to buy huge swaths of property.
We can make that distinction. As Derek mentioned, you know, remove it for the little guys, but still retain some kind of requirements so we don't get hit by a bigger developer.
I like that idea. Yeah, the trip thing. If you can say, like, hey, this development is going to generate this number of trips, you need to provide off-street parking. I think that makes sense. And that would avoid the problem, too, just from a pure code standpoint. You know, 20 years down the road, what's coming up? That would avoid this problem from ever coming up, because if you can't prove that you don't have the trips, then you wouldn't buy the property and develop it because you know you can't do it.
Okay, it's we're pushing 10 after 7.
Can I ask real quick? John, you're quiet again on this one. Did you have any thoughts?
No, other than to say I agree. Lift the restriction, lift the requirement for smaller ones. Find a threshold. I think trip generation is probably the one that triggers off-street requirements, and make it big. Because we want to encourage these small mom and pop developments on clearly small mom and pop lots, and that's how to do it. And then you've got transportation demand management. So in the big cities, like where I am right now, that's what it's all about, TDM. And so we've got the permit parking. And if we find, you know, you've got price variability to make it work if at first it doesn't work the way you want it to. So you've got a system in place now. So I'd say that's the way I'd go.
Thank you.
Okay, we can continue the parking
at the next work session. We'll get there.
Is there going to be a public hearing on that?
Yeah. Okay. The chief architect is now leaving to go get his dinner.
Are you going
to
hang around and be an applicant's representative here?
Oh, yeah. Did you include my letter in that?
Yeah, that's the first item.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Okay.
Are you a member?
Has the meeting been adjourned?
Am I what?
Are you a member?
Okay, the work session has concluded.
We were between.
Finished. At 7:10.